making the many components.
Oh, okay, this is also what I'm going to speak about. I want to begin by thanking the organizers for organizing such a nice semester and such a nice program. I'm definitely part of the related topic session this morning, although I think I will mention some connections to hyperbolic geometry as well. I'm going to speak on joint work with Tati Huayan and Julie Wang that we did in Vietnam a couple of summers ago. This paper that I'm going to speak about today will appear in Indagaciones Mathematicae, and it's also on the preprint archive. And since Barbara Kiefitz went to such great lengths to point out how important money was, I thought that I would point out that I appreciate the support from the NSF and NSA allowing me to attend. And also, I wanted to thank the Institute of Mathematics in Hanoi, where we did this work a couple of summers ago. Okay. Let's see. So let me see if I can remember to do these high-tech screens here. So I want to begin, because this is a complex, primarily a complex audience, I wanted to begin with some basic definitions. So let me just remind people what non-Archimedean absolute values are. So I'm going to begin with a field F, and a non-negative real-valued function on F is called a non-Archimedean absolute value if, when I take the absolute value of A and get 0, that only happens if I plug in 0. It should be multiplicative, so the absolute value of A times B should be the absolute value of A times the absolute value of B. And instead of the typical triangle inequality, when I take the absolute value of a sum, it should be less than or equal to the largest of the two absolute values. And then I'll skip the computation, but it's an easy exercise to see that if you have any such absolute value, then if the two absolute values don't agree when you apply the triangle inequality, you actually get equality. So this can be interpreted geometrically as saying that every point inside of a circle is the center of the circle, or every triangle is an isosceles triangle. And of course, the fundamental example for non-Archimedean absolute values, at least in number theory anyway, is the so-called p-adic absolute value on the rational numbers. Namely, if we have a rational number x, we can write it as some power of p, where p here is possibly positive or negative, times a quotient of integers which are relatively prime to p, and then we define the absolute value with respect to p to be p to the minus t. And then it's an easy exercise. Multiplicativity is clear, and you get 0. Of course, I didn't say that. If x is 0, then you define the absolute value to be 0. And so this first property is clear. The only thing to check is the triangle inequality, but if you just write it out and then factor out the smallest power of p, then you see that the strong triangle inequality holds. So for the rest of my talk, boldface F will be an algebraically closed field, complete with respect to a non-Archimedean absolute value, and I'm going to assume algebra is closed. So here the situation is a little more perhaps unfamiliar than the complex numbers. So the typical example is in the old days called omega p, these days tends to be called cp. It's called the p-adic complex numbers, and what you do is you take the rational numbers with respect to this absolute value, you form Cauchy sequences just like you do in your beginning real analysis classes, you complete that, you get a complete field called qp. It's of course not algebraically closed, but then you can take the algebraic closure. This, unlike in the case of the complex numbers, is an infinite extension, so after you take the algebraic closure, it's not complete anymore, so then you have to complete again, then you get something called the p-adic complex numbers, and then it's the theorem that when you complete that time, it stays algebraically closed, so you don't get in this never-ending cycle. Okay, so that's the basics, and this didn't work. No, it worked. Okay. And now let me talk about non-Archimedean analytic functions. At least let me give the basic idea. I'll talk about some more general analytic mappings, which maybe I won't define very carefully later, but at least for the basics, we can talk about an analytic function on one of these complete algebraically closed non-Archimedean fields, or we could also call this an entire function. And instead of trying to give some kind of local definition, let's not try to do that. Let's simply just say that it's a formal power series with coefficients in my field and infinite radius of convergence. So entire functions over C can be written as power series with complex coefficients and infinite radius of convergence, so we take that as our model. One thing that we can't do in the complex numbers is for each positive real number R, we can define another non-Archimedean absolute value on the ring of entire functions. So I'm going to denote this absolute value sub R, and what I do is I take the maximum over all n of my power series coefficients times R to the n. And this has an interesting property in the non-Archimedean case that that if you could try to do something like that in the complex numbers too, but it wouldn't be so useful. But the question is, okay, why is this an absolute value? Well, clearly you get zero if and only if all the power series coefficients are zero, so that part works. And then the fact that the triangle inequality holds is also pretty clear, because when you add two things together, then the coefficients just add term by term, and then you have the triangle inequality on each coefficient. The tricky thing is that it's actually multiplicative. So when I take two entire functions and compute FR and say another entire function G and compute GR, I get the absolute value of F times G is the absolute value of F times the absolute value of G. And if, again, I'll skip some of these details, but if you trace through what that means, it essentially boils down to something called Gauss's lemma that you learn in your beginning algebra classes. But what I do want to remark is that if I plug in Z, of course, if I take some point Z and I plug in Z, then if I then try to take the absolute value of what I get when I plug in Z to my function, then again, by the strong triangle inequality, it's going to be less than or equal to the maximum of what I get plugged in. And so that, in this notation, turns out to the absolute value of F of Z is less than or equal to the absolute value of F that's defined at that absolute value. But then we can say there's actually a significantly stronger thing. The non-Archimedean version of the maximum modulus principle says that we get equality most of the time. And here I'll be a little bit vague about most of the time. But that's another way to see multiplicativity. If you grant me the maximum modulus principle, then absolute value F of Z equals F for most Z, and absolute value G of Z equals G for most G. And if intersection of most and most should still be most, and then I can multiply that way. So and what we can use this for is that we can get much more precise information on the location of zeros of non-Archimedean entire functions just from the power series coefficients than we can in the complex case. In the complex case, if we have some entire function and then look at its power series coefficients, for example, how do you tell by looking at the power series coefficients of the function e to the z that it doesn't have any zeros? There's no real obvious connection between the power series coefficients and the zeros, but in the non-Archimedean case, that's not true at all. We can tell exactly from the power series coefficients where the zeros are. So on the previous slide, when I made these transparencies, I didn't know I would have this fancy double screen, but on the previous slide, I had this definition of absolute value F sub R. If it turns out that there exists a single non-negative integer K such that the maximum is attained really only at that one point K, then by the non-Archimedean triangle inequality, by this property that I pointed out, that if you have one of them is really bigger, then the absolute value is equal to the biggest one, it's impossible for the absolute value to get smaller, and so it's impossible to have zeros at points where none of these agree. So we can decide that there's plenty of places where an analytic function doesn't have zeros simply by determining that there's only one term in the power series where that maximum is attained. So conversely, if we have a zero, then it's at such a point where this maximum is taken on at more than one point, and those points are called critical values. And there's a theory of either Newton polygons or valuation polygons, depending on exactly what you draw, where the valuation polygon, for example, is if you sketch a graph where your input is log R and your output is log F of R, then you get a sort of piecewise linear thing, and the critical values are the corners of the piecewise linear thing, and that tells you where the locations of the zeros are. So I've written this as a location of zeros proposition. So it says for each r bigger than zero, if we let little k be the smallest term in my power series where this maximum occurs, and if I let big K be the largest term in my power series where this maximum occurs, then F has big K minus little k zeros at that absolute value. Counting multiplicity exactly.
So then the converse is also.
The converse of what? Yes. Correct. So if it has so many zeros with multiplicity, then big K minus little k is equal to the number of zeros. Okay. So again, this is kind of Gauss's lemma for the case of polynomials, and then you can do it for entire functions by a sort of Hensel's lemma, kind of approximation argument. So this is again the location of zeros proposition copied to the next slide because I wanted to refer to it, not knowing that I would have these fancy screens. But the consequence of this is that if f is non-constant, then eventually, the maximum is going to be attained further out. So this gives you an analog of Picard. A non-constant non-Archimedean function always has, non-Archimedean entire function always has a zero. So there's nothing like e to the z for non-Archimedean entire function. So of course you can change zero to any other value simply by subtracting the value that you're interested in. So if we translate this to meromorphic functions, it says a meromorphic function in the non-Archimedean case can admit at most one value instead of two. So that's the difference. Okay. So then let me talk a little bit. I'm not going to go into great detail about p-adic or non-Archimedean value distribution theory, but at various points people have looked at p-adic or non-Archimedean value distribution theory. And I would say the first place that I know of anyway where somebody looked at it is a paper that was done in the late 60s and published in 71 by Adams and Strauss called Non-Archimedean Analytic Functions Taking the Same Values at the Same Points. Many of you may be aware that Nevin-Lena has this. A consequence of Nevin-Lena's value distribution theorem is that if two meromorphic functions, the inverse image of phi values on the Riemann sphere determines uniquely a complex meromorphic function. So Adams and Strauss were interested in p-adic analogs of these kind of uniqueness theorems, and they didn't develop a full theory of value distribution theory, although by looking at their paper, it's kind of clear they could have if they wanted to, but since they were really only interested in the uniqueness application, they developed what they needed for the uniqueness application. And then more full theories were done by various people. Hafei Kwai was the first one, I think, to sort of start off trying to do this in a systematic way to recover Nevin-Lena's theory in the p-adic case. As far as I can tell, Capi Corrales Rodriguez is the first person to have proved the full non-Archimedean second name theorem. It's much easier than a complex case, but her PhD thesis in Michigan, I think, is the first one where it actually got done. It took a while to get published, so some other papers came in the intermediate case. So Kwai, together with Nguyen Quang, also eventually published the second main theorem, and then Abdelbaki Boutaba in Morocco at the time, I think, also published a non-Archimedean second main theorem. And I have references at the end of my talk for people who are interested in tracking down some of the history. So let me talk a little bit about why or maybe why not to study this. So in my own case, or as many of you have seen throughout the semester, there are a lot of connections between Nevin-Lena theory and complex hyperbolicity on one hand, and Diophantine approximation and scarcity of rational points in number theory on the other hand. So I first became interested in this when I was a graduate student. I'm a student of Serge Lang, who was interested in these kind of connections. And I started seeing some of these non-Archimedean Nevin-Lena theory papers. And I thought, well, this p-adic analysis stuff, it seems kind of like algebra, but it still has some analytic tools like derivatives. So I thought, well, these Lang conjectures relate some algebraic thing and some analytic thing. So maybe studying this can give you some insight in why these things should be related. On the other hand, that is perhaps fairly naive because, like I said, the Picard theorem is totally different. The p-adic case is much stronger, so you can't really expect to get that much insight if the Picard theorem doesn't match up. And I would say that so far, this has not really led to any kind of understanding about why the number theory and the analysis are related. But sort of once you start working on things, you sort of start getting interested in them for their own right, and I'll try to maybe convince you that there are some interesting questions in their own right. And at the very end, I'll talk about one open problem that may still lead to some insight. So, well, a couple of years out of graduate school, I changed my point of view and decided that this is not interesting because it can help you explain this connection, but it might be interesting because it's different. So the Picard theorem is different. And there are some differences between the non-Archimedean theory and the complex theory, and so I think some of these questions about what is the case in the non-Archimedean case could be considered interesting, and I'll try to highlight a couple of those. And then the last thing I want to mention that I don't know so much about, But a couple of weeks ago, there was a mini workshop on chaotic dynamics. And so Rob Benedetto, in particular, has worked out non-Archimedean analogs of a lot of classical complex analysis, such as the Alfors Island theorems and things like that. And there is now a sort of subfield about chaotic dynamics. And it's my understanding that some of that has actually been useful in studying the sort of Silverman-style arithmetic dynamics. So there is some actual application to arithmetic of these kind of non-Archimedean dynamics, which can then use some of these tools from non-Archimedean analysis. So I think that's another possible reason to study this. So let me talk about algebraic degeneracy, which is sort of the main topic of my talk today. So recall that a holomorphic curve in projective space emitting n plus 2 hyperplanes in general position is linearly degenerate. This follows from theorems of Bloch and Cartan in the 20s. So, or in fact, it's linearly degenerate. So what this says, if you take n plus 2 hyperplanes in general position in projective space, and then if you omit those hyperplanes, then there's a proper linear subspace that contains the image of your curve. So the non-Archimedean analog of this, so again, if you specialize n equals 1, you get the Picard theorem, and we saw that in the Piatek case, you get something better. Well, in the Piatek case, again, you get something better. A non-Archimedean analytic curve in PN omitting 2 hyperplanes in general position is linearly degenerate. So it doesn't grow with dimension, and I think I put a proof on here in a minute. So first let me make a remark that this is the same if the non-Archimedean analytic curve is replaced with rational curve. So I have a sort of general conjecture I have a sort of vague principle in my thesis that says a lot of things in non-Archimedean analysis, the answer to expect is whatever's true for rational curves. And I'll come back to that again. But so that's I think, and I'm probably not the first person to observe that either. But that's the thing I think to keep in the back of your mind is sort of what should be true. The answer should be related to whatever the answer is in the algebraic geometry category. Now, of course, you can cook up trivial counterexamples to that. You can say, are there transcendental entire curves? Sure. And there are not transcendental rational curves. So you can't say things like that the image should always be contained in a rational curve, because if you have P2 inside of your space, you can clearly have entire curves that are not contained in rational curves. But you could conjecture things like the non-Archimedean entire curves should be contained in the closure of the rational curves or something like that. Anyway, to prove this fairly trivial thing given the Picard theorem that I mentioned, by the general position assumption of the hyperplanes, since we only have 2 of them, you can choose projective coordinates on PN such that the first one is given by the vanishing of the first coordinate function and the second one is given by the vanishing of the second coordinate function. Then write your entire curve F. I guess I should say what an entire curve is. So an entire curve to projective space is simply an N plus 1 tuple of entire functions. And we say that 2 of them are equivalent if they differ by a constant. So by assumption that we omit those 2 hyperplanes, F0 and F1 are 0 free entire functions, hence by what we saw in the 2 slides ago, those are constant. If we have a non-constant entire function that doesn't have a 0, we don't have such a thing. Non-constant entire functions always have zeros. So those first 2 coordinate functions are constant. If the first 2 coordinate functions are constant, there's obviously a linear relation between them, and so we find the image of the map contained in the hyperplane. Let me try to connect this a little bit more to geometry as motivation for the work that I want to talk about. So again, if we take a look at projective space, this n plus 2 is the significance of n plus 2 in some sense is that it's bigger than n plus 1. And n plus 1 comes in because the canonical divisor on projective space has degree negative n plus 1. So what one could conjecture, especially since I haven't been precise here about what this conjecture says, but one could conjecture something about this, that a holomorphic curve in a non-singular projective variety with canonical divisor K and omitting a sufficiently general divisor D such that K plus D is positive, where positive means something, say big or ample or something, then you might suppose that you get an algebraic degeneracy conclusion. So again, the theorem in the non-Archimedean case was if we have an analytic curve in PN omitting 2 hyperplanes in general position, it's degenerate. 2 obviously doesn't depend on the canonical divisor, doesn't depend on n. So the question is, well, what does this depend on? So what we want to try to answer, so what I think could be sort of an interesting question in the non-Archimedean case is what what should we conjecture here? What forces non-Archimedean curves to be algebraically, analytic curves to be algebraically degenerate? And what I'm going to talk about today is at least some initial progress in that direction. So, but I want to emphasize it's not really clear what the conjecture here is supposed to be. Although maybe the algebraic geometers know what the conjecture is for rational curves, and that, well, see, this is an example. This is where trying to think of rational curves don't help you, because rational curves are always algebraically degenerate, so there's no criterion that gives you algebraic curves are rationally degenerate. So that's why in this case it's a little tricky to decide what the non-Archimedean conjecture should be. Okay, so let me look at this a little bit more. There's a theorem of Dufresnoy from the 40s that says, and then as other people have pointed out, this was also done by Fujimoto and Green later in different ways. A holomorphic curve emitting n plus k hyperplanes in general position in Pn must be contained in a proper linear subspace of dimension at most n over k. So we could look for non-Archimedean analogs of this. And the non-Archimedean analog that we get by the same proof that used to be down here, is that a non-Archimedean analytic curve omitting k plus 1 hyperplanes in general position must be contained in a linear subspace of codimension of dimension at most n minus k. And it's the same proof, right? If you have k plus 1 hyperplanes and k plus 1 is less than n plus 1, you can arrange them to be the coordinate hyperplanes. If you omit the coordinate hyperplanes, those are non-constant. Every time you get a constant coordinate function, you have a linear relation. So you get a linear relation for each omitted hyperplane past the first one, and that cuts the dimension down by one. So the corollary of this is that a non-Archimedean analytic curve emitting n plus 1 hyperplanes in general position must be constant, and this is also trivial to see. N plus 1 hyperplanes become the n plus 1 coordinate functions. If you omit all those, all the coordinate functions are constant, so your map is constant. Let me point out a theorem of Ahn that generalizes this. If F is an analytic map to an arbitrary subvariety in projective space, omitting dimension x plus 1 hypersurfaces in Pn that are in general position with x, then F is itself constant. So in general position with x means that every time you take an intersection with an additional one, the dimension actually drops. So it's kind of like complete intersection, right? Every time you intersect one more, the dimension actually goes down by one. It doesn't just cut off some components. So you can extend these theorems from Pn to other surfaces, but the dimension still seems to be sort of a crude invariant here. And as we saw for projective space, at least to be degenerate, it didn't depend on the dimension. So we want to say, well, what can we measure just besides the dimension of the space that will come into these degeneracy results? So what I want to talk about today is the non-Archimedean analog of a theorem of Noguchi and Winkelmann. And I've stated Noguchi and Winkelmann's theorem here, so let me go over this a little bit slowly. And it wasn't clear to me from the abstracts, but it's possible that Professor Winkelmann will talk a little bit about this during his talk later. So let M be a compact Kähler manifold of dimension M. And then I want to take DI to be L irreducible hypersurfaces in general position. Again, this general position means when I intersect an additional one of them, the dimension drops. And the interesting thing about this work is it brings in an invariant called the Naron severity group. So I want to let R be the rank of the group generated by the Chern classes of these divisors. So if I take one of the components of these divisors, I can then take its Chern class that lives in something called the Naron severity group, which is divisors modulo algebraic equivalence of divisors. That's a finitely generated, actually a finite, that's a finite group. And so you can, or no, finitely generated group. So you can talk about the rank of the subgroup that they generate. Anyway, we're starting off with only finitely many components, so they certainly generate a finite rank subgroup. But in fact, as you take more and more, the rank can only grow so much. And then if we have a closed subvariety of our original manifold M of dimension N and irregularity Q, so the irregularity, this is the dimension of the space of holomorphic one forms. If we suppose there exists an algebraically non-degenerate holomorphic map from the complex plane to W that admits all of these divisors DA, except the ones that possibly contain all of W, right? If it's a map to W and some of the divisors contain all of W, you can't omit those. But you omit all the ones which properly intersect with W, then you can say two things. You can, first of all, give an upper bound on the number of those divisors that properly intersect with W, and I think this is the way they wrote it in their paper, but in some ways I'd like to put the Q over to the other side. So you get an upper bound on the number of divisors which properly intersect my space with W in terms of the dimension of the space, in terms of the rank of the group in the narrow and severity group that the components generate, and then you get to subtract off the irregularity. So every time you have a holomorphic one form, the dimension gets cut down by one. And then what tends to make this narrow and severity group get big is blowing up things. So if you have a lot of exceptional divisors, every time you add an additional exceptional divisor, the bound gets worse, because you can then omit those exceptional divisors without changing anything. But if your narrow and severity group is small, you cannot omit very many divisors. You can turn this the other way around. So M was the dimension of the original space, and N was the dimension of the space that contains the image of the curve. You can turn this the other way around. As soon as the number of components is bigger than the dimension of the original space, then you get an upper bound on the dimension of the image in terms of R minus Q, again, the rank of the group generated by the components minus the one forms, and in terms of the number of components. And compare this with this, is the de Fresnoy thing here? Yeah. So compare this with this de Fresnoy theorem, where we have, as we omit more and more components, the dimension goes down something like N over K. Here you'll notice you also have, and remember, the number of components here was N plus K. So this is really N over N plus, this is really over N over N plus K minus N. So this has the same form. It's the dimension over the number of components minus M. So this is really a generalization of the de Fresnoy result. So what's nice about this from my point of view, or for what I want to talk about today anyway, is that it gives these bounds in terms of two fundamental invariants of the space, the irregularity Q and the rank of the narrow and severity group. Okay, so I think it's fair to say the difficult part of the Noguchi-Winkelmann work is looking at maps to semi-abelian varieties. So this comes out as a consequence of their various papers on second main theorems for holomorphic curves in semi-abelian varieties. There's also, particularly in the Kähler case, because they're looking at semi-abelian varieties, there's some delicate issues of compactification and things like this that come into this as well. I'm not going to talk about any of that. The situation for us is going to be somewhat simpler. Well, a lot simpler in that sense. It's going to be, there's some delicacies in our case too that I'm going to hide, but they're different ones. So now if we now look at non-Archimedean analytic maps to semi-abelian varieties, the punchline is there aren't any, and I'm going to explain that a little bit. But let me first talk about what happens for multiplicative tori. So an immediate corollary of the non-Archimedean Picard theorem, so again, this is in stark contrast to the complex case, is there are no non-constant analytic maps from A1 to the multiplicative group, because what is the multiplicative group after all? It's just the field minus zero, and we already saw that there are none of these. So if you have a multiplicative torus, it's a product of multiplicative groups, so the projections down to the factors are all constant, so that means the original map is constant. So that case is trivial. So then what happens to the semi part doesn't have any difficulty at all in the non-Archimedean case. And then the question is, what happens to abelian varieties? And this was a result of my thesis. Every non-Archimedean analytic map to an abelian variety is constant. I want to talk about that a little bit. Let me point out that, again, my perspective changed, right? I kind of like differences now more than I like similarities. But if you really want to go after similarities in a somewhat artificial way, then what you can do, and what I did a lot in my thesis, is instead of looking maps from A1, I can look at maps from A1 minus the origin. And then I have, of course, non-trivial maps to the multiplicative group. And we also do that in our paper. And then you can get, I'm not going to state them, but then you get results that are similar in form to the Noguchi and Winkelmann results, coming only from the semi-abelian variety piece, though. The abelian variety piece is the same, it turns out. They're sort of. I'll say a little bit more about that. But anyway, if you look at maps from A1 minus 0, you can get the results to look somewhat similar if you want. But I'd rather not take that perspective. Okay, so let me talk about the proof of that was in my thesis that every non-Archimedean analytic map to an abelian variety is constant. Let me also mention, though, that you can also prove this sort of more in the spirit of say the things that were being talked about earlier this week by looking at least in characteristic zero, you can sort of pull back one forms and work with the logarithmic derivative lemma and things like that. But I want to kind of give my original proof because it's characteristic free, so these non-Archimedean fields could also be in positive characteristic. And if you look at the one form approach, then vanishing derivatives in positive characteristic don't mean that your function is necessarily constant. It means it's a p-th power. So let me give my original proof. So my original proof is if f is a non-Archimedean analytic map from the affine line to an abelian variety A, there's a thing called the semi-abelian reduction theorem that says there's a semi-abelian variety G that maps onto my abelian variety A. So this is my original abelian variety A. This is my original non-Archimedean entire map. And then the semi-abelian reduction theorem says that A has a sort of cover, which is the semi-abelian variety, and there's this semi-abelian varieties are extensions of abelian varieties by multiplicative tori. So this B here is an abelian variety with what's called good reduction, and this T here is a product of multiplicative groups. So good reduction simply means if I have non-Archimedean fields, I can always take a look at the set of things which are less than or equal to 1, and then reduce those mod the set of things which are strictly less than 1. The things which are strictly less than 1 form a maximal ideal by the strong triangle inequality. And so I can reduce, if I have varieties, I can think of them as being equations, and if I reduce them modulo that maximal ideal, then I get an abelian variety over what's called the residue class field, or I get a variety over the residue class field. If it still has a group structure, if it's still an abelian variety, then I say it has good reduction. So you can do this in the category, again, I kind of want to, this is where some technicalities come in that I don't want to talk about today, but you can do this in a category of, say, rigid analytic geometry or Berkovich theory, where you actually get that this is a universal covering map. And so then you can lift the original non-Archimedean entire function up to the semi-abelian variety G, and then of course once it goes up here, you can follow this arrow over and get it to the abelian variety with good reduction. Now the basic idea is that with the abelian variety with good reduction is you can reduce the non-Archimedean entire function modulo, say P, if you're thinking in the p-adic case, and get, it turns out, an algebraic map from a rational curve to an abelian variety, and as we all know, or most of us know, there are no non-constant maps from rational curves to abelian varieties. So therefore, what that means, that's in the reduction. So what that means in terms of this analytic map is it lies above a single closed point in the reduction. And then you can also sort of study what can that look like. And if you study what that looks like, you see that the inverse images of a single closed point are isomorphic to open balls in n-dimensional space. So the component functions are bounded. And if the component functions are bounded, the analog of Picard or Liouville or whatever you want then gives you that they're constant. So we end up with H composed with this map being constant. That map being constant means that the image of H exactly lies in the translate of the multiplicative torus, and we already saw that maps to the multiplicative torus are constant, so that means H itself had to be constant, and if H is constant, well, we get F by going like this, and so that's constant as well. So the idea is to first consider the case of abelian varieties with good reduction, to do an argument to see that those have to be constant. We did a separate easy argument to see that maps completely to multiplicative tori are constant, so therefore maps to semi-direct products of abelian varieties with good reduction and multiplicative tori are constant. And then this big theorem, the semi-abelian reduction theorem, finishes the case for general abelian varieties. Let me not transfer the slide. Let me hit one more button here. So I didn't put it in my thesis, but what we actually need is then the thing for the arbitrary semi-abelian variety. But we can use this part of this argument that I've outlined in red once we have the case for abelian varieties, now we can change B to be any kind of abelian variety, because now we know the image to any kind of abelian variety is constant. Repeat this argument: if G is any semi-abelian variety, we get the map to any semi-abelian variety is constant. So, handled in a different way, basically all the most complicated part of the Noguchi and Winkelmann paper just goes away for us, because we don't have any maps at all to semi-abelian varieties. So then our theorem, putting together the ideas of Noguchi and Winkelmann with this sort of different results for semi-abelian varieties, let me state it this way first, and then I'll state a corollary which looks like maybe a little more similar to their theorem. So let Y be a possibly singular projective variety, and let I be a morphism from Y into a smooth projective variety X. Basically, the case that we're most interested in here is that Y is a subvariety of X, but we didn't actually need that in our argument, so we stated it more generally, where we just have any kind of map from Y to X. And then we want to let DI be L irreducible effective divisors on X, and then again, we want to look at the, again, if you think of Y as being a subvariety, we look at the intersections of the divisors with Y, and we assume that they form L distinct effective divisors on Y. So again, we're counting the number of those divisors which give us proper divisors when we intersect with Y. And then we assume that those number of components L is larger than the rank of the subgroup they generate in the narrow and severe group of the bigger space X. Then any analytic map from A1 to Y is either algebraically degenerate or intersects the support of one of those divisors restricted to Y. Again, I've stated everything more generally, but the way to think is consider Y as a subvariety of X. If too many of the divisors properly intersect Y and you manage to stay out of them, then your image could not fill up all of Y. And let me give an example to say that this is essentially the best you can do. So it's clear, right, that you can find an algebraically non-degenerate map from A1 to A2, just take two transcendental power series which don't have any kind of algebraic relation to them. And then maybe a little bit more work, but it's sort of clear that even though that image is not contained in any proper algebraic subvarieties, it should still admit a whole bunch of points. Right? Somehow the image of these two things can't sort of hit everything. So what we can do is we can obtain a new variety by blowing up some finite number of general points that are not contained in the image of F. And then notice I put A2 instead of P2 because I wanted to also keep the hyperplane at infinity free. So the hyperplane at infinity is not hit, and then we can find some other finite number of points which are not hit, blow those up, and then we can take a collection of these of R divisors, which come from the exceptional divisors of the R minus 1 points that we blew up, plus the strict transform of the hyperplane that we omitted, and that gives us R divisors which we omit, and of course those divisors, those components actually generate the full narrow and severe group of the blow up. So we can omit exactly, we can cook things up so that we get exactly one component as generators for the narrow and severe group, and we can omit all those. So before we can get any kind of degeneracy result, we need at least more than the rank of the group generated by the component. So, So then a consequence of this thing that's over on the other slide, is then this: if I have a similar Y going to X and F going to Y, if I have more components, right, the way I stated it here, this is basically the same thing stated in a different way. It's the same thing actually stated using less lines so that I had room for the proof. Again, I didn't know I was going to have two two screens. So this is the same theorem, but just written in a condensed way. And then what I wanted to do is talk about how we prove the theorem. So in order to prove this theorem, what we're going to do is we're going to take an analytic map from A1 to Y. Remember, I said Y could even be singular, and the reason I wanted Y to be singular is I really wanted to think of Y as being subvarieties. I really want Y to be the, say, the Zariski closure of the image in X. So I want to allow singularities, but I can lift my map to the normalization. It's not too hard to see that you can lift analytic maps to the normalization, unless they're sort of contained in the indeterminacy locus. But if they're in the indeterminacy locus, they're degenerate. So we can find integers AI, exactly the assumption, the fact that we have more irreducible components than the rank of the group they generate in the narrow and severe group exactly means that there's some linear relation on the Chern classes of these divisors. So exactly our assumption says there's a non-trivial linear relation on the Chern classes of the divisors, and what that then exactly means is that this divisor here is a non-zero divisor algebraically equivalent to zero on the normalization. So now what happens when we have divisors that are algebraically equivalent to zero? Well, if the irregularity is positive, it's not so clear what that means. But if the irregularity is positive, and here I don't really want to have the irregularity be the thing about the dimension of the space of one forms. Here I want the irregularity really to be the dimension of the, to handle positive characteristic, I want the irregularity to be the dimension of the Albanese variety. So if the Albanese variety has positive dimension, then Y-twiddle maps to an abelian variety, and because we saw that the image in the abelian variety is constant, that means that our function had to be degenerate. So if we're just trying to prove algebraic degeneracy, we might as well assume that it doesn't have any non-trivial maps to abelian varieties, which means exactly that the Picard variety, which is the cardioid dual of the Albanese variety, is trivial. And then in that case, algebraic equivalence and linear equivalence are the same. So if we have an algebraically equivalent, a divisor which is algebraically equivalent to zero on such a variety, it's linearly equivalent to zero, which means we can find a rational function whose divisor is exactly given by that. But if F omits the support of all these things, then that exactly means that H composed with F is entire and zero free. So if we have an entire function which is zero free, by what we already saw, it's constant, and therefore F is algebraically degenerate because it lies in the inverse image of H under that constant. So that gives us our degeneracy result. And then this is the corollary. If we add to this the assumption that the DI are ample, so on the previous things that we were working with, we were just working with effective divisors, but if we throw in ample, and the point of ample is that if you have an ample divisor, then every single one of them has to actually intersect the image of the curve because ample divisors intersect, always intersect positive dimensional subvarieties, right? So if the thing is non-constant, the ample divisor will always intersect the image of the curve if it's positive dimensional. So if we basically combine this result with some combinatorial counting, this part I'm going to skip, but now we really do exactly what's in Noguchi and Winkelmann's paper, where they sort of carefully keep track of indices and do some combinatorial counting, and we find out that if Y is a closed positive dimensional subvariety of a non-singular variety, if I have L irreducible effective, and I should have really highlighted ample, now I've added the assumption ample divisors in general position on X. If R is the rank of the subgroup they generate, just like it was before, and if there exists an algebraically non-degenerate map from Y omitting each of the DI that does not contain all of them, we can look at this one of two ways. Either we can bound the number of components in terms of the dimension of Y, or we can bound the dimension of Y in terms of the number of components. And the numbers work out slightly different, but it's the same argument in the case. One thing that I do want to point out here is that and I haven't made up my mind about this yet. I just sort of noticed this while I was preparing this talk, but if you remember back in the Noguchi and Winkelmann result, they always had R minus Q. So having higher irregularity always improved their bounds. All of their bounds were in terms of R minus Q. We don't have any Q terms because we kind of got rid of that in a sort of trivial way. So now the question is, can we look at that in some sort of more sophisticated way and improve these estimates by bringing in Q? And I need to think a little bit more about whether I think we can do that or not. But that's possibly something left to do along these lines. Let me make some other remarks. In the case of projective space, this inequality was already proven by, in projective space, if I remember right, it's this first inequality, the one that's the larger of them, and that already appeared in the paper of An Wang and Pittman Wong. The other reason, in some sense, we didn't think so much carefully about whether we could improve this with Q is examples tend to leave us to believe that if the components are actually ample, that we should be able to make this bound independent of the rank anyway. And so we were trying to do something better than the dimension. Noguchi and Winkelmann gave us the idea that the narrow and severe group was something to look at. And that's definitely important in the effective cases. I showed in the case of effective divisors, you definitely need a term involving the narrow and severe group. But in the ample case, it seems like it should be independent of R. And I'll talk about some later work of Julie Wang and her student that start in that direction. And as I just said, it might be possible to improve this estimate by incorporating a term involving the irregularity of Q, but I need to think about that a little more carefully before I commit to that. So more recent work of Lin and Wang is the following. Suppose we have a map from A1 to X minus L divisors. So if each of the DI is pseudo-ample, so pseudo-ample is Langian terminology for big, the nice thing about it, though, is you don't have to remember what it means because you know what ample means, and then pseudo means, well, almost ample. So, but anyway, if you then also assume that the intersection is empty, so this is kind of a general position hypothesis, and then almost an ample hypothesis, then you get that F is algebraically degenerate. And if each DI is ample and L is bigger than the dimension, then those conditions are satisfied and F is constant. So here's an example where ample divisors don't depend on the rank of the narrow and severe group. The trouble with this is it just tells you about constants. It doesn't give you an estimate on actually the dimension of the image. So we still don't have an estimate on the dimension of the image independent of the rank of the narrow and severe group. But anyway, we can get if we have the sort of an ampleness or big assumption, we can get things independent of the dimension. And Lin and Wang are a little braver than I am. They actually make a conjecture that says if you have a non-Archimedean analytic curve omitting L ample divisors in general position, then it's contained in a proper algebraic subvariety of codimension at least L minus 1. So they give a conjecture on what they think the estimate should be. Maybe they have more examples than I do to be convinced of that, but could be right. Okay, so that's the main substance of my talk. That's the work that's going to appear in Indagaciones. I want to sort of make some concluding remarks back on my original theme of why I look at these kind of questions or what other things can you do. So again, taking my point of view that now the reason that this might be interesting is differences and not similarities, let me point out differences in defect relations. So this audience more or less, I think, knows what defect relations is. So in complex analysis, as far as I know, in all the cases that we know, the maximal deficiency sum that comes out of a consequence of a second main theorem is also the same as the maximum number of things that can be omitted. So, for example, an algebraically non-degenerate map in projective space can omit n plus 1 hyperplanes in general position. If you do the second main theorem for hyperplanes and you have an linearly non-degenerate map, the defects add up to n plus 1. A non-constant map can omit 2n hyperplanes. If you look at non-constant maps, the defect relation adds up to 2n. So it seems like that you always get the defect relation and the number of things that can be omitted being the same. This is definitely not true in the non-Archimedean world. We saw in projective space, if you omit two things, you're already algebraically degenerate. But for the defect relation, that's definitely not true. You can choose an algebraically non-degenerate map by just picking these coordinate functions to grow faster and faster and faster. And then, if Fn grows so much faster than all the rest of them, the first n hyperplanes will be deficient, but they'll be hit. So in this case, the deficiency sum adds up to n, even though we can only really omit 2. So there seems to be a difference between what we get by deficiency sums, which are somewhat less trivial sometimes, than what we can get by assuming that the thing is omitted completely.
So what is the second main theorem?
For Pn? Yeah, n. If you don't have a ramification term, n. If you have a ramification term, it's n plus 1. With the ramification term. Without the ramification term, it's 1 better. Another, I think, from a number theorist perspective, what I think are maybe the most interesting are big Picard-type extension theorems. And let me give you, a theorem and an example. So a theorem is a non-Archimedean analytic map from the punctured disk to an elliptic curve with good reduction, meaning J invariant having absolute non-Archimedean absolute value less than or equal to 1, extends to an analytic map from the disk. So if we have maps to elliptic curves with so-called good reduction, then we have an analog of the big Picard theorem. This follows from this same kind of Berkovich kind of picture that the abelian variety thing followed from. On the other hand, if you have an elliptic curve with non-integral J invariant, then Tate has this multiplicative uniformization of them, and if you restrict that uniformizing map to the unit disk, that definitely doesn't extend. So in this case, whether or not maps extend not only depend on the coarse geometry of these are both elliptic curves, right? So all the coarse geometric invariants, like the genus and the dimension, are the same. And so what determines the extension property is a more subtle fact, namely the reduction type. And that's something that so far doesn't appear in complex analysis. So this is a sort of interesting feature of, I think, of p-adic analysis, where the reduction type sometimes affects the extension theorems. And then let me end with K3 surfaces, which also came up in the last talk. So again, in Langian terminology, what people call general type, Lang calls pseudo-canonical. And again, you don't have to remember what it means. Something is pseudo-canonical if its canonical divisor is pseudo-ample. Green-Griffiths conjecture has been mentioned a couple times. A holomorphic curve in a pseudo-canonical variety is algebraically degenerate. Lang has a stronger version of that conjecture. Maybe this is also due to some other people earlier, but he says if you have a non-singular general type variety, then there's a proper algebraic subvariety Z of X independent of the curve that contains the images of all the non-constant holomorphic curves. And then in my thesis, I conjectured, so again, sort of in the spirit that things are one better in the p-adic case, K trivial is one better in the p-adic case. So in my thesis, I conjectured that the image of a non-Archimedean analytic curve in a K3 surface is simply connected trivial conical divisor, must be contained in an algebraic curve, hence a rational curve. Let me point out why I think this is interesting. So the non-Archimedean conjecture has some features in common with Green-Griffiths in that it's trying to prove that things are degenerate. On the other case, there's a lot more structure and a lot more is known about K3 surfaces than arbitrary general type varieties, so maybe there's some hope that there's more tools to somehow do this. On the other hand, it could in principle be more difficult if you believe the Lang thing, because some and presumably all K3 surfaces contain infinitely many rational curves. In fact, loosely connected with this last talk is this conjecture of Bogomolov that if you have any two algebraic points on a K3 surface, it should be connected by a chain of rational curves. So this means definitely for the case of K3 surface, there's not a fixed proper subvariety that contains all the images of non-constant, non-Archimedean analytic maps. So if you're going to handle this problem, you have to be able to deal with the possibility that they're not all contained in some fixed subvariety. And so I think in terms of my original motivation, if there could really be any progress on this problem, that really could be where there is some insight into an unsolved problem in the complex case, namely the Green-Griffiths conjecture. I've been working on this on and off for 20 years and haven't gotten anywhere. I suppose there's some possibility. Time is a little more on my side than few seems to think it is on his side, but still, I invite other people to think about this problem because I think it would be interesting to see what happens here. So I think that's enough for me.